Hello everybody, welcome back. I'm delighted today to be joined by Harry Halpin. He's the CEO of NIM Technologies, and we're going to have what I think is an incredibly important debate around the topic of privacy and data protection in Web 2, Web 3, and the wider world. Harry, how are you getting on today? Are you well?
I'm going pretty well. I'm currently calling in from Beirut, Lebanon, where I was giving an intensive cryptocurrency course because the people here are dealing with hyperinflation and of course is the everyday privacy issues which everyone has to deal with. Like, how do you make sure that possibly, you know, some sort of enemy nation state isn't looking at your communication, or just how can I access, you know, Netflix properly? And these are all really questions that I'm dealing with both personally and with people here every day.
There we go. So already a very broad spectrum of use cases or issues that you're interested in tackling. And we'll go across the full spectrum today because I think it's important for people to understand at an objective level, why does privacy matter? Or why does protecting our data or our metadata matter in the world? Who are the bad actors? Or really just a case of how can we give people more agency in how they manage their data? And why does Web3 and decentralized tech help with that? So I know NIM's been championing the cause for a long time. It's one of the biggest names in Web3. For those who've been around for a long time, NIM will have a certain value or a certain cachet to most people. But for those who don't know about you and about NIM Technologies, could you kind of give us a little bit of the origin story? What have you guys been working on? And what's the kind of key story about NIM?
Yeah, so I'm the co-founder and CEO of NIM Technologies. So we're a Swiss-based startup focused on privacy. We have pretty large group of people, about 40 or so. And we have produced essentially working privacy solutions based on blockchain technology. In particular, what we have built is a mixnet. The story of NIM comes actually from the Snowden revelations, when various European governments were very upset that they, even, you know, the Prime Minister of Germany was being spied on by the NSA. And they said, is it possible to build software that can prevent even the NSA, somebody with a God's eye view of the internet, from spying on me? And we, as a bunch of, at the time, researchers, I'm at the time working for the French government at INRIA de Paris, I said, yes, we can. And myself and George Tenesis, Claudia Diaz, and others, we built the first version of the software. But then push comes to shove, you know, we decided that we wanted to make a startup from it. We wanted to bring this level of privacy into the hands of ordinary people. So we essentially use a blockchain to discover what we call a mixnet. And a mixnet mixes packets together on a large scale. And that's what kind of defeats the NSA level adversaries. And if it can defeat the NSA level adversaries, it could defeat probably any adversary that you're worried about that could be spying on you.
There we go. The NSA is probably the final boss of all final bosses in terms of the level of sophistication or the level of complication of the problem. I'm interested, from your background, was privacy always something that you felt particularly drawn towards as a problem statement? Was that something that kind of pre-existed your research days?
I mean, I did my PhD at University of Edinburgh up in the UK, in the Scotland, to be precise. And at first, I was actually much more interested in artificial intelligence. My PhD thesis was more on language models, which are now very hot, thanks to ChatGPT. But while doing my thesis and playing with these artificial intelligence tools, which were fairly powerful even 10 years ago, it occurred to me that these tools could be easily used to take away people's privacy. So, you know, they were being trained on personal data. They could infer personal data from very minor amounts of data. You could infer, for example, people's sexual orientation. You could infer whether they would get ill or not. And these were all with high degrees of accuracy. And it struck me that this technology could be kind of dangerous. And it became personally dangerous for myself. I was a climate change activist. I was very involved trying to bring attention the climate change issues, and I helped organize a protest in Denmark at what's called the COP15, perhaps. I'm not sure which number it was, but I was targeted for arrest as an organizer, so I experienced a lot of surveillance firsthand as well. And then it occurred to me, well, if this could happen to me for something in my opinion, fairly sensible and more or less at this point publicly acceptable as preventing catastrophic climate change, then it could really happen to anyone. And so that really influenced me to change my direction of my activities away from more traditional web standards. I worked with Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, on something called the W3C Crypto API. I led that effort to standardize crypto across browsers. But what I was always very interested in is how do you prevent artificial intelligence or other kind of programs from absorbing the metadata, the information about who's communicating to who, and how to obscure that so it can't be used to essentially hurt people. So even when we're talking over the internet today, anyone who's observing the server my computers connect to and your computers connect to, they can look at the kind of fingerprint of bits going back and forth that server, and they can identify with a high degree of precision, that I'm talking to you. And that's pretty dangerous, I think. People should have the freedom to associate and speak to people without third parties knowing everything.
Got you. And that could be malicious, that could be surveillance, that could be helpful, right? I mean, you mentioned artificial intelligence is really just an accelerator for joining dots. You train those language models, or you train those models to look for particular data points or to observe particular data points and make inferences quickly. That could be just the sort of thing like, you're about to get ill. Would you like some vitamins?
I mean, I use artificial intelligence every day. I encourage students to use ChatGPT. I don't try to stop them from using it because we're going to grow up with these tools, and these tools are going to get more and more powerful. But fundamentally, it boils down to choice. Am I unwittingly, without my real consent, being harvested for data, and someone's trying to manipulate me to take away my freedom of thought? Is this happening? Or, am I willingly giving my data to an AI or just another third party in order to help me? And I'm totally okay with the latter if I have conscious choice over the matter, because I believe that handing my data over will make a better world or a better life for myself, then I think it's completely acceptable. But you really disempower yourself if at every moment you're giving away data and you don't even know that you're doing so. And then this data, which is sort of a part of your body and mind, is turned against you. So that's it's used to manipulate you and control you. And I think that's the real danger. So I think, it's really all about choice and freedom and giving people that level of elementary freedom in terms of control over their data and who knows what about who.
A really strong start. Harry, let's talk about mixnets. You introduced that concept at the beginning of the show. Tell us a little bit about how they work and why are they particularly important?
Yeah, so mixnets were invented by David Chaum, a very famous cryptographer in the kind of early 80s. And the way you want to think about it is, if you're trying to hide information from someone or something, there's effectively two components to the problem. One is to hide the content of the information, and the second is to hide the fact that you're communicating with someone else. So if I'm hiding the content of the communication, I encrypt it. That's what happens when you see this lock in your browser. That means that the connection between my browser and the server is encrypted using a protocol like TLS, so that third parties can't easily steal my banking information, my username, my password, or that when I'm talking to, but they do know that I'm talking to a bank. So the question with mixnets is there a way to obscure the fact that I am talking to a bank? And while cryptography is honestly, very complicated and involves a lot of number theory, mixnets are relatively straightforward to understand. What they do is kind of like spam. They do what they say on the box. It mixes the packets together. So packets come in from different users talking to different people. Those packets are mixed together, shuffled, like a deck of cards, and then after a certain amount of mixing or shuffling, they're released. And we have several kind of unique takes on this technology, but you can see how that the packets don't come in first in, first out order, but they're kind of their order being released is randomized. You do this two or three times in a row, that this makes it harder and harder to track where the original packet came from. And then what NIM does in addition to that is we have a specialized mixing strategy, which is based on something called a Poisson process. This is a little bit complex mathematics, but essentially it's a sort of distribution where you can determine how long on average it takes a particular packet to go through a mix, but you never know with certainty if a packet has gone through the mix. Now, the packet may wait a long time there or may wait a very short time. It's chosen randomly from this Poisson distribution. And that randomizes the order of the packets, but then also provides you as a user something very important, which you want to know how long it's going to take for my packet, my bit of information on the internet, to get from point A to point B. We also add what's called dummy traffic. So one objection could be, you know, well, maybe it's mixing up packets, but when I go offline or I turn my computer off, how does it know the enemy or someone watching my computer would know that I'm no longer communicating with the mixnet? So we provide fake traffic. So if not enough people are using it or you're not using it, there's a kind of constant flow of traffic to the mixnet, fake traffic when you're not using it, real traffic when you are. And that increases the privacy of everybody. And then I think that the second main innovation of NIM is that essentially, you know, the blockchain won't save the world, but it does have some uses. And one really important problem when you connect to Mixnet, which you can view as a kind of VPN on some levels, like a super VPN, is you have to find the first connect. You have to somehow, where's the entry point? How do I get inside? And we put that information on a blockchain. And we basically take these computers that mix your traffic up. We call them mixed nodes. And we give them a kind of ranking or reputation score using a NIM token. And the combination of these two things, blockchains being somewhat censorship proof and peer-to-peer broadcasting, combined with this more strict mixing process, allows you to discover where the first hop into the mixnet is. And also allows you to basically choose a reliable and get high quality of service in terms of bandwidth, in terms of speed, in terms of things that people that use VPNs and mixnets are interested in from this kind of new mixnet technology. So that's really the key of what a mixnet is. I don't know, was that sufficient? Did that make sense?
Super helpful. And I like the VPN analogy as well, right? I've seen you present before where the kind of the VPN is just, you know, point to point, but there's a redirection in the middle, whereas a mixnet is point to point, but you've got a whole shuffling that goes on in the middle, which I think you've verbally explained very well.
I want to take a second on the VPNs.
Go for it.
It's important to remember that, you know, when you're using a VPN, that, you know, the VPN is encrypting your traffic to the VPN and it's hiding your IP address behind the VPN's IP address. But any website you're visiting to gets the VPN's IP address. And the VPN itself has 100% transparency into what you're doing. So maybe let's say I'm going to my bank, I'm going over VPN. Now maybe my ISP, my telco provider, doesn't know I'm going to the bank. They just think I'm going to VPN. But my VPN provider knows that I'm going to the bank. And that could be dangerous. All these VPN companies are very shoddy. Who knows who's running them? It's a bunch of random people you may or may not trust. Personally, I trust very few VPNs. The nice thing about Mixnet is you don't have to trust NIM. You don't have to trust me. The Mixnet just mixes up the packets in a trustless and decentralized fashion. And it goes through more than one node. So it's impossible with large statistical bounds, unless, like, you know, 80% of the network is corrupted by an adversary, for them to basically decrypt and de-anonymize your packet. And that's really important, that the mixnet itself, you don't have to trust me, you don't have to trust my CTO, you don't have to trust my programmers, you don't have to trust the people running the nodes themselves. You have to, the trust is distributed and decentralized throughout the entire system. So VPNs are inherently centralized and you're inherently putting your trust in the VPN provider. And that's not the case with a mixnet. or Tor for that matter.
What I'd love to double click on is the unmixing process, right? Because I think people can visualize or imagine the shuffling process, right? At some point, mm-hmm. you want to communicate with another peer or somebody else on the network. It could be with a business, it could be with an individual, it could be with a government, it could be with whoever else, right? You are sending a packet of information. You're going to send it. It's going to get scrambled. How does the person on the other end unscramble?
Yeah, so it's this actually, weirdly enough, it's a little bit similar to how the internet itself works. When I send packets to the internet, they have a kind of numbering on them, and they arrive often out of order, and it's up to your computer to take those numbers and say, look, this will put the things back in the right order, and then we'll understand what data is in the packet. And we at NIM, we use this thing called the Sphinx packet format to essentially take each of your whatever you're sending on the mixed end and divide into packets. Those packets are of equal size. If they're a bit too small, we add some padding, some fluff to the packet to make it all the same size, because otherwise you could distinguish packets based on their size. They go through the network, they go through the mixing, and then the receiver just sits there and receives these packets, and they can decrypt them. So when they decrypt them, they get what you consider like a sequence number. So the packets which are fake, they just drop. The pack, if they get things out of order, they just wait till they get the packets in the correct order, the bits that they're missing, and they put it all in the right order, and then they can decrypt the entire message and do whatever data processing they want. And you know, they can send acknowledgments back so let's say I send out a packet and it gets lost or it gets never received, I would never get an acknowledgement back. So I would then send again. And this sounds like a really slow and cumbersome process, waiting for these packets, decrypting them, putting them back in order. But actually, you know, it can happen in our case. We've seen performance on the mix that we can mix packets and ship them through at like about 500 milliseconds. So that's this whole process of sending packets through, decrypting them, putting them back together. This is all thanks to the magic of computers and high-speed encryption. This can all happen very quickly.
Thanks for clarifying that. So, I mean, there's this constant flow of packets, but on both sides, the system or the algorithm will understand which packets are intended for who, and the recipient will be the only ones who can drag those out of the algorithm and then be able to put them back.
Yeah, the recipient's the only one that can decrypt them. And, you know, your packets can mix with other people's packets, but your recipient is receiving a mixture of junk packets and packets that were destined for itself. And then once it gets enough of them, it can put everything in the right order and then process that data, do whatever it wants to do with that data. So that could be browsing a web page, that could be sending a message through Telegram, that could be sending a Bitcoin transaction. All that works over the mixnet today.
Gotcha. And that's about as concise and clear a description of what is relatively complex technology I think anybody needs to understand now. What I'd love to get into now is the why, the importance of protecting privacy, the importance of data preservation, because you introduced it at the beginning. It could be everything from just, I want to send something and not have it intercepted versus I don't want to be surveilled. And I also don't want to create bias around this conversation in saying that all of this is about preserving and protecting ourselves from the NSA. Or from Big Brother, or from the Illuminati, or whoever else is out there to get us. Because actually, I believe that privacy is a fundamental right. It's a fundamental freedom. And the right to privacy, or the importance of privacy, can appear in a whole bunch of different places. So I'd love your take rather than mine on where are we seeing this be most important today? And what do you think, or what do we think, are some of the applications that scale later on?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you have to say that, you know, When you use privacy technologies, if like no one else is using it, if you're the only person using it, then you sort of stand out. You know, very few people are concerned with the NSA, and rightfully so, but people should be concerned about crime, about identity theft, about being harassed or stalked, about simply being a victim of manipulation and advertising and fake news. All of this is becoming more and more predominant, and it's being focused on larger and larger swaths of the population. And mixnets are one of the few technologies that can really prevent this sort of devious behavior at scale. So it's kind of a killer app insofar as that I think it's about as fundamental to internet technology as encryption itself. Privacy should be just as important as encryption, just as you have the right to access a banking app and pay for stuff without worrying that someone's going to steal your credit card number or steal your identity. People should be able to communicate over the internet privately without having to be worried that someone's is going to know who they're talking to and when they're talking to them exactly, and use that to predict their behavior, manipulate them. There's been work from MIT by Sandy Pentland that shows that up to 80% of behavior can be predicted simply by watching who's talking to who and when and ignoring what they're saying, which is incredibly dangerous. So I think that we'll see these kinds of technologies that violate privacy being used not just by governments, but by companies and by cyber criminals in order to, for example, crush their identity theft, in order to crush competition. And I think privacy is fundamentally not just important for human freedom, which it is, but important for fundamentally allowing invention on the internet. And I say invention, allowing creative thinking and creative being creative. And the killer app will probably be something that looks like a VPN that anyone can just turn on and then feel safe and secure in their internet browsing so that they don't believe that their telephone company or Google or Facebook or someone else is watching them. And I think that's possible, and we at NIM will deliver something in that space by end of the year. Something as simple to use as a little on and off button for internet privacy.
I'm sure that's not alpha, but I'd love to double click on that or kind of share as much as you're able to at this time. So are we going to see a NIM VPN?
Yeah, I think we'll probably see something as simple to use as a VPN by end of the year. Right now, if you use NIM, it's a little complicated. You have to basically, someone using NIM with Telegram, I have to open Telegram, I have to open what we call NIM Connect, which is a bit of software which enables this, the MixNet, and you have to then manually connect the two. It only takes a minute, but a lot of people won't do that. What we really need is a simple on-off button for privacy on the internet. And I think we will obtain that by end of the year. Now I'll send you a little invite code once it's working.
Super excited to see that and give it a try, because I mean, the easier we can make the applications, obviously at the moment it's not embedded in the internet, right? TCP/IP and other internet protocols do not have this level of privacy baked in, and so we have to retrofit it.
I used to work with Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web. I worked on security under him. I worked on the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, which invented TCP/IP in the 70s. And fundamentally, the problem with the web and the internet is they were invented in trusted, often very academic environments. There wasn't money going around. It was about researchers sharing data sets, sharing papers. And there was no theory that, you know, nation states or companies or criminals would try to harm people or influence them. And, that's what's happening today. So we have to upgrade the internet. And it's one of, I think, our great generational challenges is to make the internet fundamentally a space of freedom again, a privacy-preserving space of freedom. Otherwise, it risks becoming a kind of corporate nightmare of control. I think that's very dangerous in the long run.
I hear you. Or a wild west of kind of loose metadata that anybody can make inferences into and so on. And I'd be really interested in your observations in some of the Web 2 to Web 3 movement lately, because this is something that I've observed, I've written about. And I understand where it's coming from. But when you see the likes of Meta, right? So Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, WhatsApp, and also Amazon, looking at connecting doxed profiles to Web 3 wallets. The first thing that you can observe there is that, okay, well, the second that you've got a doxed profile connected to a pseudonymous wallet, you now have a non-pseudonymous wallet, right? So that wallet is now forever attributed to you. And then because of Web3 and the way blockchains are organized today, all of the transactions, you know, whether it's your wallet to someone else's wallet, payments that you've made and so on and so forth, those financial transactions, while largely pseudonymous, are still open to interpretation and big data analysis. And I think that's risky. You know, I think that's providing a further level of detail and data that, frankly, we shouldn't be giving to any social media organization.
Yeah, it sounds crazy. You know, Satoshi Nakamoto had some thinking about defending this against defending user privacy with pseudonymous keys. But now with, you know, ETH domain names, if I want to discover what NFTs Vitalik owns or how much ETH he actually has and what causes he's donated to and who he sent money to, I can just walk over and with a domain scanner and look at Vitalik.eth and I can see exactly what Vitalik has. It's public knowledge whose account is whose. You saw this morning when it looked like yesterday, where, you know, CZ said, Justin, don't try to, you know, partake in the Sui token sale, because you could see, everyone knows who where Justin Sun's wallets are. You could see that Justin Sun was moving some of the Tron money into Binance, right? So you have these, you don't want, you know, I like Twitter. I use Twitter a lot. I like LinkedIn. I post about what I'm thinking, where I am, what I'm doing, but I do that selectively. I don't do it for everywhere I am all the time. But what you don't want is you don't want your bank account to be look like a Twitter feed. You don't want all of that information to basically be public and posted the moment you make a purchase. That's actually worse than cash. That's worse than credit cards. So, you know, I think it's our job as people who are working in Web3 to make that technology privacy preserving. I think that's going to be it's not going to be, the problem with privacy is kind of viewed often as a optional or boutique feature of a protocol, something maybe a few crazy people would want, but something that's not really that important. But I think in order to get any level of adoption among people, including, you know, normal people, you're going to have to at least have parity with the features of banks and cash. And part of that parity is privacy. People will want some level of privacy by default, definitely more they get on Web3 now.
100%. And I think we need to try and normalize that privacy is something that people deserve, or that it's a right or it's a freedom, as opposed to it, like you said, being something that only conspiracy theorists find of value. Yeah. Because the more that we have digital assets that are held on blockchains, or the more that we see transactions between us and our friends' wallets that are on public infrastructure, that are up and available 24/7, but then available for anybody with a block explorer to go and look at, actually, that's not necessarily a good thing all of the time.
Yeah, and it allows for front running of trades. So if you're a trader, it's kind of bad for you. It allows for your social graph of who you've sent money to and what you've done to be mapped, to be used to track information about particular companies and their movements. It's all incredibly valuable. People underestimate what you can do looking at that data. And right now you have a rapid rise in artificial intelligence algorithms, which are very good at kind of predicting the future from past data. And while some part of me is excited to see that those artificial algorithms work on blockchain tech, another part of me is very worried that we will lose, you know, having all my financial transactions on chain will basically make me an open target for manipulation or hacking. You know, no one wants to wake up in the morning and see their wallet drained of funds. And so we need privacy really badly on chain. And not just on chain. I mean, NIM operates primarily on the layer below the blockchain. We operate on the actual network level. So we want to disguise the fact that you're even talking to a blockchain, what blockchain you're using, when you're using it. And I think we can, you know, make that default behavior for all wallets. So one thing that NIM is doing is we're working with a lot of other wallets. We actually got it working on MetaMask. We've got it working on Electrum and Blockstream Green, which are Bitcoin wallets. We've got it so that when you connect to your wallet, you know, you have a light client, usually something on your phone or your laptop, and that connects to a full node, a computer somewhere on the internet, and that's just someone else's computer, and that we can disguise the location and your transactions from that full node to a large extent. So that we think that all wallets should at some point incorporate NIM, so that they can basically get this level of privacy when they talk to the rest of the blockchain universe.
Got you. And we're starting to get into the kind of the technologies and enablers. So we'll kind of jump onto the next one. And before we get into zero knowledge or the kind of the underlying technology primitives or capabilities, I wanted to take a beat on Tornado Cash, because that's one example of an application that was intended to be privacy preserving or, you know, data protecting in terms of being able to move funds between parties without having the transparency or the same level of transparency as native layer one blockchains. And surely enough, certain national entities and regulators looked at that and said, that doesn't comply with our regulations. We need to have financial transactions be visible. We need to have KYC for, you know, monetary value movements within our economic area. Therefore, this sort of privacy preserving technology is a bad thing. Are we ever going to be able to come back on that and have national regulators look at privacy tech saying, actually, you know what, we would like everything to be private all the time? Or do you think that's going to be a hurdle that we're going to struggle to overcome?
I think the U.S. government overreacted in the case of Tornado Cash. So what was happening is that Tornado Cash was suspected of the U.S. government by being used to basically hide the transfer of funds from various hacks done by North Korean government back to North Korea. North Korea is on what's called a sanctions list. They're a sanctioned entity. It's illegal to trade with them, to send them money, to interact with them, basically. And therefore they're on this what's called the OFAC sanction list. And when it became, I think, clear to the U.S. government that North Korea was perhaps using Tornado Cash because they couldn't figure out how to stop North Korea, they said, well, it's easier to stop Tornado Cash. And they did something which is historically unprecedented, which is they put software itself on a sanctions list. Usually sanctions lists are for people, you know, like terrorists, for example, or drug dealers or whatever, not for code. That's very unusual. So you might put like Hezbollah on a sanctions list, but you won't put, you know, Windows on a sanctions list. The fact that they did that, I think, shows that they were panicking and didn't really understand the situation very well. And then there was this mysterious arrest of one of the developers who they claim was somehow helping people evade sanctions. Now, I want to make two points. First, the first point is that, you know, that arrest and that putting Tornado Cash on OFAC sanctions, I think, was just the wrong way to deal with it. If you want to stop North Korea, don't go after the code North Korea is using. Don't go after people that make code that can be used by anyone, and we can't tell if it's being used by North Korea or not. Go after North Korea. I think that's sort of obvious. If you have a problem with North Korea, then the U.S. government has a problem with North Korea, then the U.S. government should go after them. They shouldn't necessarily force other governments to or other people, and they shouldn't necessarily push so hard by putting code on a sanctions list. The second point is that the fundamental, it's a mistake to go after privacy and say it's only used for kind of bad purposes, because it's used for a lot of good purposes. You know, Tornado Cash was very much used, I believe, to help fund, you know, Iranian dissidents who are trying to get freedom in Iran, you know, not just a few months ago. It's been used to basically just disguise people's transactions, people that don't want their ETH transactions connected to them. It's been used quite a lot by all sorts of people, and to take such a valuable service down shows a real lack of foresight, because actually privacy is good, not just for people, but for governments. Governments want to keep their secrets private from other governments. If you made some sort of US CBDC and you put the entire, all the transactions of US citizens on a blockchain, that would be a legitimate national security threat to the United States of government, right? Other governments, for example, the United States may not be getting along with, like China, could come along and look at that data and use that to predict the US's behavior, to go after people in the US, to understand how the US works. So financial data is valuable data, and it should be private by default, because otherwise it's a risk not just for the individuals, but for the country as a whole. So, and I do believe that there are people in various governments who slowly but surely are realizing that demonizing privacy is not the right way to go. The second point is that, is there a way to do what you want to do without destroying privacy? Do you have to turn off privacy on the blockchain in order to prevent North Korea from using a privacy-enhancing mixing service? Of course not, right? We have very good identity schemes and very good zero-knowledge proof schemes that let us do exactly that. That let us prove that, you know, I'm a human and I'm not from North Korea, and that I have someone that's attested to that through a KYC procedure, for example, KYC AML procedure that's done the proper due diligence. And I can carry around a little certificate that I've had a due diligence done to me and show you that certificate without necessary, and that certificate is mathematically shown to be valid without necessarily having to hand over all my personal data. So, you know, I know NIM is interested in this issue. You know, we, as a company, we have to be compliant. It's a part of being compliant is, you know, we do, for example, we KYC to everyone who we give tokens to make sure they're not from North Korea and to make sure they're not on a sanctions list. And in order to, what we would like to do, because it's dangerous to hold all that personal data, holding that personal data is actually more dangerous than not holding it. It becomes a honeypot. If I hold the passports of thousands of people, then I can be attacked on that because those passports are valuable. Someone might want that personal data to do, for example, banking fraud. So it's better that we have a KYC system where people can prove stuff about themselves, selectively disclose it, without having to hand over all their passports and show it to the video camera, and talk to someone and send the proof of residence and a bill. And that, it seems so old fashioned and not really in the spirit of blockchain technology. So I think that's these sort of ID processes, a process that we should do once and then should save using zero to, you know, our home computer, and then basically use zero knowledge proofs to convince people, other people, that we are indeed who we say we are. And they, you might just need to convince someone that you're not an American or that you're not on a sanctions list or that you are, you know, you are Swiss, so you could vote. These sort of use cases, I think, will become more important. And zero knowledge proofs, which let you prove something without revealing anything else about the subject, will become essentially, I think, mainstream in the next 2 or 3 years.
There's certainly been enough discussion, debate, and activity around them, which is super important because zero knowledge proofs have been discussed for about 5 or 6 years now. They're not new in the world, but we're starting to see them being applied at scale and the use cases for them being given more credence. I think it's important what you said about KYC because if you take the Tornado Cash example, NIM is trying to do the exact same thing, right? So theoretically, you know, somebody could sanction NIM as privacy-preserving software if you continue down that road, which obviously would be bad news for you guys and wouldn't be something that anybody would want. The current regulatory way around that, as you described, is to then say, okay, well, all NIM users have to be KYC'd. So then at that point, you're moving the point of trust from the mixnet then to NIM as an entity that has to hold centralized KYC data. And so it's not a perfectly trustless system in that model anymore.
Yeah, although just to be clear, because it's sometimes a little bit not obvious, because NIM operates sort of like a VPN, it operates on the packet level. So we actually don't have the KYC NIM users, thank God. That would be very dangerous. We don't want to do that. And we don't ever want to do that. And the reason is, again, holding that information is dangerous and there's no reason to. And that's because under at least most government regimes, except some places like Iran and China, running a VPN is legal and it goes by something which is called the intermediary lack of liability. So if I am an intermediary, I'm just a pipe which is shipping bits around, then I'm not liable for what's in those bits, just as Google isn't liable for what it indexes and presents as search results on the web. That being said, where you do become liable, you do have to apply all of this kind of KYC sanctions regime checks is in the case of financial transactions. So there's certain lower limits and upper limits and they kind of change. There's actually no lower limit to sanctions checking, to my knowledge, but there is lower limits to financial, certain kinds of financial checks. And that these are to do with cryptocurrency. So whenever we transfer cryptocurrency, we have to be very careful But when people use NIM, so far they don't have to. That being said, you know, because we don't have to check people that use NIM, NIM is already blocked in China and in Iran, for example. So we're having to work with some very talented hackers from those regions to fix that as we speak. So we do think that that everyone should have the right to use NIM. But I do want to distinguish between what NIM does, which is provide kind of privacy over the whole internet connection, from privacy on the blockchain, where the blockchain is like an application running on top of the internet, where the transactions themselves can either be private or not.
That's an important clarification, and apologies for kind of leading.
Oh, no, I just want to make sure people knew. I mean, if you do win NIM in an award, we will have to KYC you, because we have to make sure you're not an American, for example. But if you just want to use it, you can download and use it and not ask us. And we will fight very hard to keep it that way.
Exactly. And that's the question of, you know, at some point down the road, is that where we end up? Because if anything can be obfuscated by anyone anywhere, obviously the financial regulation may be stronger, more pervasive at the moment. But where do we go next?
I'm very worried that, you know, governments will try to strip privacy rights away. But then, like I said, it's a poison cup, because as soon as you citizens lose their privacy, governments then lose their privacy, and then the governments themselves losing their privacy means that, to a large extent, that they themselves can also become victims of surveillance and control methods. So,
And centralized authorities for very important life critical systems and monetary systems, that's something you don't want to see.
Yeah, and I hope common sense prevails, so that privacy technologies are just considered, you know, good hygiene for using the internet in the future. I hope eventually become a default usage. The scaremongering around is ridiculous, but you know, the scaremongering around privacy, what we saw with Tornado Cash, happens every few years. And you know, it happened in the 90s where they tried to ban encryption. Had they banned encryption in the 90s, had they, you know, actually put Phil Zimmerman in jail for releasing encryption in public, we wouldn't have e-banking today. We wouldn't have eBay. We wouldn't have Amazon. We wouldn't have all these things that, to be honest, I think most of us take for granted and use every day. And on that same level, we have to defend ourselves in this new fight. And so one thing that NIM has done is we've taken all the Web3 privacy companies, everyone from Orchid, which is a kind of decentralized VPN provider, to Electric Coin Company, which are the companies behind Zcash, to Manta, which produces great zero-knowledge technology, to Secret, which is kind of a secure hardware company. All of the privacy-enhancing technology companies are coming together to work together to make sure that something like Tornado Cash doesn't happen again. And the big difference between what's happening now and the 90s is that because blockchain technology has been heavily funded, that, you know, the people in the 90s were fighting back against the U.S. government with very little resources. And we have a lot of lawyers and we have a lot of funding, and we're willing to take, if a government does something extreme to damage privacy and damage one of the members, I think operating together will give us a better chance of succeeding in court. And, you know, ultimately when you fight for what's right, you will have to fight it out eventually. And we're just preparing a way for that. So that's called the Universal Privacy Alliance, and that's at privacy-alliance.org if you want to read about that.
I would suggest most people do, and having a macro organization or a meta organization, whichever you prefer, meta is probably a poor choice in this context, but having an umbrella organization that is funded to advocate for privacy in an objective way through modern and emerging technologies is something I think is useful in the world. I don't know, outside of those, you know, projects specifically or yourselves, who we should consider as the kind of bastion or the beacon for privacy education today.
Tor is doing a good job. Signal, the application which allows encrypted end-to-end messaging, is doing a good job. And within the United States, the EFF, the Electronic Freedom Frontier Foundation, and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, does a good job. In Europe, EDRI is a nonprofit that fights for privacy. And you're seeing, you know, Brave and other people, other web browsers stand up for privacy. So I think we're getting, On some level, things are looking scary, but then another level, it just shows what's happening is actually more and more people are interested in these technologies and using them, and we're having more and more companies ban around it. So, we'll be at Brussels in like 2 weeks to discuss privacy and privacy enhancing technologies and why and how they should be legal with European lawmakers.
That's super powerful. And I mean, great to see that it's happening. And I guess also very good news that there are a number of organizations that we can already look to in terms of those who are leading the line. So thank you for sharing that. And anyone who's listening in, take note because there's already plenty more reading you can do following on this particular episode. I'd love to take a beat on zero knowledge as well, if we can, because
Yeah.
we picked it up, we mentioned it, and I've seen zero knowledge explained in some very detailed ways. I've seen and heard zero knowledge explained as magical math, which is possibly the least accessible way of describing a technology, if you want to believe in it and follow it. How do you talk to others about ZK and why it's useful?
We consider ZK to be, privacy is basically an holistic property of an entire system. Right. So I'm using a VPN, but then I use the VPN to access Facebook. Even if I'm using the VPN, Facebook knows where I am. Right. So you have to have privacy in all layers of the system. And NIM is a mixnet that operates on the lowest level. Because if you don't operate at the lowest level, it's like building a castle out of sand, right? Eventually the tide will come in and your castle will fall apart. But you also have these higher levels, including blockchain technology. And what is blockchain technology trying to do fundamentally? It's trying to make sure, why do you have a blockchain to begin with? It's both to ensure some level of decentralization, but also to ensure, that there's only so much, for example, Bitcoin or tokens printed, that there's not secretly a lot of inflation going on, that everyone is. That the SEP is trustless. I don't have to trust a centralized third party for control over my money or my digital assets. And the question is, if everything was encrypted, if you kind of think about, could if everything was just take a blockchain and just magically encrypt all of the units on it, all of the blocks, how could I guarantee those properties? How could I say, well, how do I know that this person really has this amount of money? Or that I really have this amount of Zcash or Monero, or that how do I know that the Zcash team isn't secretly printing more Zcash? I could tell with Bitcoin, I can count it up, it's 21 million, but how do I know it's Zcash? And that's really where zero knowledge proofs come in. And I mean, there's no good explanation of zero knowledge proofs. I mean, I have dealt with them for a number of years now. When I was working at MIT, Madaris Virsa, a friend of mine, was working on this thing called LibSnark, which later became Zcash, down the office. And we always thought that the explanation in Wikipedia, which of all these caves and whatnot, was passed through caves, was quite bad. But then the actual math is a little tricky. The way that I would say the way to think about it is that I can, the nice thing about computer programs is that they're universal. There are certain things that computer programs can do, which can be broken down into basic bits of logic, like X and or Y, for example. And that these particular kinds of breakdowns, adding stuff, subtracting stuff, that's what you need to understand how much money you have, what the inflation is, and that these kinds of what you would consider constraints, maybe, that build a computer program or some checking of a computer program. These can be mapped to particularly to kinds of math, and particularly what's called polynomial equations. And these polynomial equations essentially can serve as constraints. So you can prove that something is true without while there being many other things which is, are not proven about a particular mathematical constraint system. So I can say, it's true that I have this much money, or it's true that when I spent money, I didn't go beneath zero, right? I can prove these kinds of things by essentially mapping them to a little computer program which says, yeah, this number in the guy's account, it's always above zero. And then that maps to a kind of mathematical equation, which then I can basically make a statement about, and which doesn't reveal anything else. And that's not maybe that is actually what's going on with particularly with Groth 16. And there's many different zero knowledge systems. But the way to think about it is you take something that's common sense, that's obvious, that you want to prove, such as, you know, I'm not from North Korea. You encode in some particular way. And that coding is a map to underlying mathematical function that you can make statements about without revealing the whole function. That's probably not the best explanation either, but that is, I think, at least fairly accurate.
It's helpful. And I've struggled myself to try and describe this. It's essentially there is a pool of data that you will have others create inferences on without sharing all the data. You're going to respond to a question. Am I old enough to enter this facility? Am I on a country that has a sanctions list? I'm not going to tell you my address, my age, my date of birth. I'm not going to give you any other credential other than what's needed to answer the question you have. Although I accept that you are asking me this question. I've bought into the idea that you are going to figure out what my nationality isn't in asking that question. And I'm okay with that in this system.
So we call it, we have a particular zero knowledge scheme that we use at NIM, which is currently in testnet and moving to mainnet, called ZK-NIMS. And the way to think about those, which are a little bit easier to understand than like standard zero knowledge proofs, is that it's kind of like an ID card. And I could show this ID card to someone. And when I show my passport to someone, I want to prove, let's say that I'm an American. When I show that ID card to someone, it reveals a lot of stuff about me that's not really that interesting, about not necessary to reveal if I'm just trying to prove I'm American. It reveals my birth date, my place of birth, my full name. It reveals quite a lot. But imagine there was a kind of passport that you could pull out. Like, you don't have to even open it. It just says, look, it's clearly the American passport. He's holding it. And that's his picture. That's him. But we don't need to know anything else about him. Or, you could pull one out that just showed your birth date, but kind of scramble the text on your name. And that's the kind of use cases that this technology enables. And I think, ZK-NIMS, which is the technology that NIM is using for zero knowledge on the blockchain, is very powerful and very general purpose, and will have more and more usage. The important thing for us, what are we interested in, right? If we're going to run this thing like a VPN company, we're interested in taking payments. But, you want to pay for privacy? You want to give your credit card data with your name and the credit card information to a third party, maybe your address usually, to verify? In order to have privacy, well, that seems very privacy invasive right there. So we hope we can use ZK-NIMS, zero knowledge proofs, as a way to do private payments. So you can pay us for privacy, and we don't need to know who you are. We don't need to know when you're accessing the mixnet or why you're accessing the mixnet. You could just do it yourself. And we think that's a really important use case of private payments.
That's a really good one. You're basically creating the zero knowledge CRM. It's saying, I want you to be my customer. I want you to pay me money. I want you to use the service that I'm providing, but I don't want to know who you are.
Yeah. And I think we can create that technology today, and that might give people more confidence in using the service, because they will know that we don't know, we can't dox them, we can't identify them, but they can still prove that they paid for the service. And I think as zero knowledge CRMs, these sort of things could become very important, right? Right now there is simply just too much personal data floating around. And, half sentient life has had their passwords hacked. And this is at some point just going to get unacceptable as more and more of our life moves into the digital space and the internet.
Love that. I think the zero knowledge CRM has got a huge amount of applications out there on the internet. The number of online services today that would love to have your money, but you don't want people finding out that you're serving or that you're buying services from. Very, very, very long list. I'm conscious we've got a couple of minutes left, Harry, and I probably want to ask one more question, then maybe we'll take one from the audience. Is, how do we create more agency in having people manage privacy? Because the underlying infrastructure or layer zero sitting underneath a blockchain in what NIM is today is not necessarily an application that most people can use. We talked about embedding NIM or privacy preserving or data protection capabilities in wallets or apps. How do we get this on the radar and in regular active usage of more people more of the time?
Well, I mean, I think if you look, there have been huge success stories in privacy over the last few years. People may not know this, but Signal, which was encrypted end-to-end messaging, was originally viewed as a sort of weird thing that only, you know, weird people who wanted privacy would use. But actually, Facebook was like, I am so tired of responding to government data requests about WhatsApp that they just enabled end-to-end encryption on WhatsApp using something that is basically the Signal protocol. And that's the same thing is happening now. Elon Musk is discussing, can I turn on end-to-end encryption with Twitter DM so that me, Elon Musk, I can't read your Twitter direct messages? That's been all on the cards for a number of years now. And so at this point, if you're using WhatsApp, if you're using Facebook Messenger even, if you're a lot of these chat applications have end-to-end encryption. I think it's going to be the same with privacy, that originally privacy will be taken up probably by a few cutting-edge individuals, people that already use things like VPNs, just want a better VPN. And, you know, that might be a pretty small percentage of people. Not clear. I mean, VPN usage is like 1 out of 8 people on the planet. So maybe, let's say, you know, 1 out of 10 people's interest in privacy. So maybe 1 out of 80 people would be interested in using something like NIM. Small but sizable. But that as more people demand privacy from the applications, and more and more companies realize that privacy can save them money, so they don't have to respond to so many requests, that they don't have to hold so much user data, that reduces the threat that their threats of being hacked, their threat of losing customer data, that privacy will become more and more acceptable and will eventually just be the default. I don't want people to have to install an app just to become private. Right now, that may be what you have to do. I would like people fundamentally to be private by default. So how do we reach large users? I mean, you know, we have been talking to Brave for a number of years now. We think at some point, some of the Web3 browsers, like the Brave browser, will just enable privacy by default, similar to the Tor browser does today. And that this will slowly, slowly kind of snowball so that more and more apps become privacy preserving by default. And then you'll be viewed as a weirdo, as an exhibitionist for someone that wants to, like, I don't know, put all of their data on a blockchain and let the whole world see it.
I hear you. And it's a good point. I think normalizing privacy, normalizing that within the technology stack or in the application stack, and making it easy for those third parties who have applications today that aren't privacy preserving or data preserving, making it easier for them to adopt and adapt, I think is going to be important too. So we've got an education, we've got a visioning and messaging, and we've also got a technology enablement component. But all seems feasible. Seems like there's already a good number of people working in this space, myself included. And Harry, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. For those listening in, we've had some questions and we've run out of time, but I'll try and get back to those some other way, maybe in the comments or in the follow-ups.
Okay. Yeah, I could. I mean, if I could try to view them and make comments on your LinkedIn profile, for example.
You can. There's a particularly interesting question here from Iraklis about the blockchain trilemma. And I think it's relating to the layers in the stack, but we'll let you get to that separately. Thank you for taking the time to come into the comments. Thank you for taking the time to bless the show with your explanations and your descriptions of what's going on with NIM, with zero knowledge, with privacy more broadly. And have a brilliant rest of your day. Enjoy Lebanon.
Yeah. Thanks. I look forward to seeing you. And make sure to just, you know, check us out on LinkedIn or Twitter, whatever you use. And you download the software and give it a shot. We'd be very happy to hear what you have to say. NIM Technologies, we're still a fairly new company, but one thing that we really value is people who want to give things a shot. And just download NIM Connect and give it a try and get back to us. Thanks so much.
Awesome, Harry. Thanks so much. See you soon.
Cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast. As always, opinions in this episode are mine and those of my guests alone. If you want to find out more, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out some of the other episodes on the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast and check out the YouTube channel, also called Blockchain Won't Save the World. Stay safe out there.